Freedom of the Will by Jonathan Edwards. Part 3, Section 5. In the sermon audio listings of the sermons thus far, this would be Part 10. Part 10. Section 5. That sincerity of desires and endeavors, which is supposed to excuse, in the non-performance of things in themselves good, particularly considered. It is much insisted upon by many that some men, though they are not able to perform spiritual duties, such as repentance of sin, love to God, a cordial acceptance of Christ as exhibited and offered in the gospel, etc., and yet may sincerely desire and endeavor after these things, and therefore must be excused, it being unreasonable to blame them for the omission of those things which they sincerely desire and endeavor to do, but cannot. Well, concerning this matter, the following things may be observed. Number 1. What is here supposed is a great mistake and gross absurdity. Even that men may sincerely choose and desire those spiritual duties of love, acceptance, choice, rejection, etc., consisting in the exercise of the will itself, or in the disposition and inclination of the heart, and yet not be able to perform or exert them. Well, this is absurd, because it is absurd to suppose that a man should directly, properly, and sincerely incline to have an inclination which at the same time is contrary to his inclination. Or that is to suppose him not to be inclined to that which he is inclined to. If a man, in the state and acts of his will and inclination, properly and directly falls in with those duties, he therein performs them. For the duties themselves consist in that very thing. They consist in the state and acts of the will being so formed and directed. If the soul properly and sincerely falls in with a certain proposed act of will or choice, the soul therein makes that choice its own. Even as when a moving body falls in with a proposed direction of its motion, well, that is the same thing as to move in that direction. Number 2. That which is called a desire and willingness for those inward duties, in such as do not perform them, has respect to these duties only indirectly and remotely, and is improperly so called. Not only because, as was observed before, not only because it respects those good volitions only in a distant view, and with respect to future time, but also because evermore, not these things themselves, but something else that is foreign, well, that is the object that terminates these volitions and desires. A drunkard who continues in his drunkenness, being under the power of a violent appetite to strong drink, and without any love to virtue, but being also extremely covetous and close, and very much exercised and grieved at the diminution of his estate and prospect of poverty, may in a sort desire the virtue of temperance. And though his present will is to gratify his extravagant appetite, yet he may wish he had a heart to forbear future acts of intemperance and forsake his excesses, through an unwillingness to part with his money. But still he goes on with his drunkenness. His wishes and endeavors are insufficient and ineffectual. Well, such a man has no proper direct, sincere willingness to forsake this vice and the vicious deeds which belong to it. For he acts voluntarily in continuing to drink to excess. His desire is very improperly called a willingness to be temperate. It is no true desire of that virtue, for it is not that virtue that terminates his wishes, nor have they any direct respect at all to it. It is only the saving of his money, or the avoiding of poverty, that terminates and exhausts the whole strength of his desire. The virtue of temperance is regarded only very indirectly and improperly, even as a necessary means of gratifying the vice of covetousness. So, a man of an exceedingly corrupt and wicked heart, who has no love to God and the Lord Jesus Christ, but, on the contrary, being very profanely and carnally inclined, has the greatest distaste of the things of religion, and enmity against them. Yet, being of a family, that from one generation to another, have most of them died, in their youth, of a hereditary consumption, and so, having little hope of living very long, and having been instructed in the necessity of a supreme love to Christ, and latitude for his death and sufferings, in order to his salvation from eternal misery. If under these circumstances he should, through a fear of eternal torments, wish he had such a disposition, but his profane and carnal heart remaining, he continues, still, in his habitual distaste of and enmity to God and religion, and completely without any, exercise of that love and gratitude, as doubtless the very devils themselves, notwithstanding all the devilishness of their temper, would wish for a holy heart, if by that means they could get out of hell. Well, in this case, there's no sincere willingness to love Christ and choose him as his chief good. Well, these holy dispositions and exercises are not at all the direct object of the will. They truly share no part of the inclination or desire of the soul. But all is terminated on deliverance from torment. And these graces and pious volitions, notwithstanding this forced consent, are looked upon as in themselves undesirable. As when a sick man desires a dose he greatly abhors in order to save his life. From these things it appears, 3, that this indirect willingness is not that exercise of the will which the command requires, but is entirely a different one, being a volition of a different nature, and terminated altogether on different objects, completely falling short of that virtue of will to which the command has respect. 4. This other volition, which has only some indirect concern with the duty required, cannot excuse for the want or lack of that good will itself, which is commanded, being not the thing which answers and fulfills the command, and being wholly destitute of the virtue which the command seeks. And further, to illustrate this matter, if a child has a most excellent father that has always treated him with fatherly kindness and tenderness, and has in every way, in the highest degree, merited his love and dutiful regard, and is withal very wealthy, but the son is of so vile a disposition that he inveterately hates his father, and yet, apprehending that his hatred of him is like to prove his ruin, by bringing him finally to those abject circumstances, which are exceedingly adverse to his avarice and ambition. He, therefore, wishes it were otherwise. But yet, remaining under the invincible power of his vile and malignant disposition, he continues still in his settled hatred of his father. Now, if such a son's indirect willingness to love and honor his father at all acquits or excuses before God for his failing of actually exercising these dispositions towards him, which God requires, it must be on one of these accounts. First, either that it answers and fulfills the command, but this it does not by the supposition, because the thing commanded is love and honor to his worthy parent. That's the fifth commandment. If the command be proper and just, as is supposed, then it obliges to the thing commanded, and so nothing else but that can answer the obligation. Or, number two, it must be, at least, because there is that virtue or goodness in his indirect willingness that is equivalent to the virtue required, and so balances or countervails it, and makes up for the lack of it. But that also is contrary to the supposition. The willingness the son has, merely from a regard to money and honor, has no goodness in it to countervail the want of the pious filial respect required. Sincerity and reality in that indirect willingness, by the way, Edwards capitalizes willingness with a W in all this, which has been spoken of, does not make it the better. That which is real and hearty is often called sincere, whether it be in virtue or vice. Some persons are sincerely bad, and others are sincerely good. And others may be sincere and hearty in some things, which are in their own nature indifferent, as a man may be sincerely desirous of eating when he is hungry. But being sincere, hearty, and in good earnest is no virtue unless it be in a thing that is virtuous. A man may be sincere and hearty in joining a crew of pirates or a gang of robbers. When the devils cried out and besought the Lord Jesus Christ not to torment them, it was no mere pretense. They were very hearty in their desires not to be tormented, but this did not make their will or desire virtuous. And if men have sincere desires, which are in their kind and nature no better, it can be no excuse for the lack of any required virtue. And as a man's sincerity in such an indirect desire or willingness to do his duty, as has been mentioned, cannot excuse for the want of performance, or the lack of performance. And so it is with endeavors arising from such a willingness. The endeavors can have no more goodness in them than the will of which they are the effect and expression. And therefore, however sincere and real, and however great a person's endeavors are, yea, though they should be to the utmost of his ability, unless the will from which they proceed be truly good and virtuous, they can be of no avail or weight whatsoever in a moral respect. That which is not truly virtuous is, in God's sight, good for nothing, and so can be of no value or influence in his account to make up for any moral defect. For nothing can counterbalance evil but good. If evil be in one scale, and we put a great deal into the other of sincere and earnest desires, and many and great endeavors, yet there be no real goodness in all, there is no weight in it. And so it does nothing towards balancing the real weight, which is in the opposite scale. It is only like subtracting 1,000 nothings from before a real number, which leaves the sum just as it was. Indeed, such endeavors may have a negatively good influence. Those things which have no positive virtue have no positive moral influence. Yet they may be an occasion of persons avoiding some positive evils. As if a man were in the water with a neighbor to whom he had ill will, and who could not swim, holding him by his hand. Well, this neighbor was much in debt to him. The man is tempted to let him sink and drown, but refuses to comply with the temptation, not out of love to his neighbor, but from the love of money, and because by his drowning he should lose his debt. That which he does in preserving his neighbor from drowning is nothing good in the sight of God. Yet hereby he avoids the greater guilt that would have been contracted if he had designedly let his neighbor sink and perish. But when Arminians, in their disputes with the Calvinists, insist so much on sincere desires and endeavors, as what must excuse men, must be acceptable of God, etc., well, it is manifest they have respect to some positive moral weight or influence of those desires and endeavors. Accepting, justifying, or excusing on the account of sincere endeavors, as they are called, and men doing what they can, etc., has relation to some moral value. That's what the Arminian thinks. Something that is accepted as good, and as such, countervailing some defect. But there is a great and unknown deceit arising from the ambiguity of the phrase, sincere endeavors. Indeed, there is a vast indistinctness and unfixedness in most, or at least very many, of the terms used to express things pertaining to moral and spiritual matters, whence arise innumerable mistakes, strong prejudices, inextricable confusion, and endless controversy. The word sincere is most commonly used to signify something that is good, and men are habituated to understand by it the same as honest and upright, which terms excite an idea of something good in the strictest and highest sense. Good in the sight of him who sees not only the outward appearance, but the heart. Therefore, men think that if a person be sincere, he will certainly be accepted. If it be said that any one is sincere in his endeavors, well, this suggests that his heart is good, and that there is no defect of duty as to virtuous inclination. He honestly and uprightly desires and endeavors to do as he is required, and this leads them to suppose that it would be very hard and unreasonable to punish him, only because he is unsuccessful in his endeavors, the thing endeavored after being beyond his power. Whereas, it ought to be observed that the word sincere has these different significations. Number one, sincerity, as the word is sometimes used, signifies no more than reality of will and endeavor with respect to anything that is professed or pretended, without any consideration of the nature of the principle or aim whence this real will and true endeavor arises. If a man has some real desire, either direct or indirect, to obtain a thing, or does really endeavor after it, he is said sincerely to desire or endeavor, without any consideration of the goodness of the principle from which he acts, or any excellency or worthiness of the end for which he acts. Thus, a man who is kind to his neighbor's wife, who is sick and languishing, and very helpful in her case, makes a show of desiring and endeavoring her restoration to health and vigor, and not only makes such a show, but there is a reality in his pretense. He does heartily and earnestly desire to have her health restored, and uses his true and utmost endeavors for it. He is said sincerely to desire and endeavor after it, because he does so truly or really, though perhaps the principle he acts from is no other than a vile and scandalous passion, having lived in adultery with her. He earnestly desires to have her health and vigor restored, that he may return to his criminal pleasures. Or, number two, by sincerity is meant not merely a reality of will and endeavor of some sort, and from some consideration or other, but a virtuous sincerity. That is, that in the performance of those particular acts, that there are the matter of virtue or duty. There be not only the matter, but the form and essence of virtue, consisting in the aim that governs the act, and the principle exercised in it. There is not only the reality of the act, that is, as it were, the body of the duty, but also the soul, which should properly belong to such a body. In this sense, a man is said to be sincere when he acts with a pure intention, not from sinister views. He not only in reality desires and seeks the thing to be done, or qualification to be obtained, for some end or other, but he wills the thing directly and properly, as neither being forced nor bribed. The virtue of the thing is properly the object of the will. In the former sense, the man is said to be sincere, in opposition to a mere pretense, and show of the particular thing to be done or exhibited without any real desire or endeavor at all. In the latter sense, a man is said to be sincere in opposition to that show of virtue there is in merely doing the matter of the duty, without the reality of the virtue itself in the soul. A man may be sincere in the former sense, and yet in the latter be, in the sight of God, who searches the heart, a vile hypocrite. In the latter kind of sincerity only is there anything truly valuable or acceptable in the sight of God. And this is what in Scripture is called sincerity, uprightness, integrity, quote, truth, in the inward parts, close quote, and, quote, being of a perfect heart, close quote. And if there be such a sincerity and such a degree of it as there ought to be, and there be anything further that the man is not able to perform, or which does not prove to be connected with his sincere desires and endeavors, that man is wholly excused and acquitted in the sight of God. His will shall surely be accepted for his deed, and such a sincere will and endeavor is all that in strictness is required of him by any command of God. But as to the other kind of sincerity of desires and endeavors, having no virtue in it, as was observed before, it can be of no avail before God, in any case, to recommend, satisfy, or excuse, and has no positive moral weight or influence whatsoever. Corollary number one. Hence it may be inferred that nothing in the reason and nature of things appears from the consideration of any moral weight in the former kind of sincerity, leading us to suppose that God has made any positive promises of salvation or grace or any saving assistance or any spiritual benefit whatsoever to any desires, prayers, endeavors, striving, or obedience of those who hitherto have no true virtue or holiness in their hearts, though we should suppose all the sincerity and the utmost degree of endeavor that is possible to be in person without holiness. Some object against God requiring, as the condition of salvation, those holy exercises, which are the result of a supernatural renovation, such as supreme respect to Christ, love to God, loving holiness for its own sake, etc., that these inward dispositions and exercises are above men's power, as they are by nature, and therefore that we may conclude that when men are brought to be sincere in their endeavors and do as well as they can, they are accepted. And that this must be all that God requires in order to their being received as the objects of His favor, and must be what God has appointed as a condition of salvation. Well, concerning this, I would observe that in such manner of speaking, as men being accepted because they are sincere and do as well as they can, well, there is evidently a supposition of some virtue, some degree of that which is truly good, though it does not go so far as were to be wished. For if men do what they can, unless their so doing be from some good principle, disposition, or exercise of heart, well, some virtuous inclination or act of the will, their so doing what they can is, in some respect, not one whit better than if they did nothing at all. And in such a case, there is no more positive moral goodness in a man doing what he can than in a windmill doing what it can. Because the action does no more proceed from virtue. And there is nothing in such sincerity of endeavor, or doing what we can, that should render it any more a fit recommendation to positive favor and acceptance, or the condition of any reward or actual benefit, than doing nothing at all. For both the one and the other are alike nothing as to any true moral weight or value. Corollary number 2. Hence also it follows, there is nothing that appears in the reason and nature of things, which can justly lead us to determine that God will certainly give the necessary means of salvation, or some way or other bestow true holiness and eternal life on those heathens who are sincere, in the sense above explained, sincere in their endeavors to find out the will of the deity and to please him according to their light, that they may escape his future displeasure and wrath, and obtain happiness in the future state through his favor. Part 3, section number 6. Liberty of indifference, not only not necessary to virtue, but utterly inconsistent with it, and all, either virtuous or vicious habits or inclinations, inconsistent with Arminian notions of liberty and moral agency. To suppose such a freedom of will, as Arminians talk of, to be requisite to virtue and vice, is many ways contrary to common sense. If indifference belonged to liberty of will, as the Arminians suppose, and it be essential to a virtuous action that it be performed in a state of liberty, as they also suppose, it will follow that it is essential to a virtuous action that it be performed in a state of indifference. And if it be performed in a state of indifference, then doubtless it must be performed in the time of indifference. By the way, Edwards is capitalizing the word indifference. And so it will follow that in order to the virtue of an act, the heart must be indifferent in the time of the performance of that act. And the more indifferent and cold the heart is with relation to the act performed, well, so much the better. Because the act is performed with so much the greater liberty. But is this agreeable to the light of nature? Is it agreeable to the notions which mankind in all ages have of virtue, that it lies in what is contrary to indifference, even in the tendency and inclination of the heart to virtuous action? And that the stronger the inclination, and so the further from indifference, the more virtuous the heart, and so much the more praiseworthy the act which proceeds from it? Well, if we should suppose, contrary to what has been before demonstrated, if we should suppose that there may be an act of will in a state of indifference, for instance, this act, that is to say, the will determining to put itself out of a state of indifference and to give itself a preponderation one way, well, then it would follow, on Arminian principles, that this act or determination of the will is that alone wherein virtue consists, because this only is performed while the mind remains in a state of indifference, and so in a state of liberty. For when once the mind is put out of its equilibrium, it is no longer in such a state. Therefore, all the acts which follow afterwards, proceeding from bias, can have the nature neither of virtue nor vice. Or if the thing which the will can do, while yet in a state of indifference, and so of liberty, be only to suspend acting, and determine to take the matter into consideration, well then this determination is that alone wherein virtue consists, and not proceeding to action after the scale is turned by consideration. And so that it will follow from these principles that whatever is done after the mind, by any means, is once out of its equilibrium and arises from an inclination, has nothing of the nature of virtue or vice, and is worthy of neither blame nor praise. But how plainly contrary is this to the universal sense of mankind and to the notion they have of sincerely virtuous actions, which is that they proceed from a heart well disposed and well inclined, and the stronger, the more fixed and determined the good disposition of the heart, the greater the sincerity of virtue. And so, the more of its truth and reality. But if there be any acts which are done in a state of equilibrium, or spring immediately from perfect indifference and coldness of heart, they cannot arise from any good principle or disposition in the heart, and consequently, according to common sense, have no sincere goodness in them, having no virtue of heart in them. To have a virtuous heart is to have a heart that favors virtue and is friendly to it, and not one perfectly cold and indifferent about it. And besides, the actions that are done in a state of indifference or that arise immediately out of such a state, they cannot be virtuous because, by the supposition, they are not determined by any preceding choice. For if there be preceding choice, then choice intervenes between the act and the state of indifference, which is contrary to the supposition of the act arising immediately out of indifference. But those acts which are not determined by preceding choice cannot be virtuous or vicious by Arminian principles, because they are not determined by the will. So that neither one way nor the other can any actions be virtuous or vicious according to those principles. If the action be determined by a preceding act of choice, it cannot be virtuous, because the action is not done in a state of indifference, nor does immediately arise from such a state, and so is not done in a state of liberty. If the action be not determined by a preceding act of choice, then it cannot be virtuous, because then the will is not self-determined in it, so that it is made certain that neither virtue nor vice can ever find any place in the universe. Excuse me. Moreover, that it is necessary to a virtuous action that it be performed in a state of indifference, under a notion of that being a state of liberty, is contrary to common sense. As it is a dictate of common sense, excuse me, that indifference itself, in many cases, is vicious, and so to a high degree. As if when I see my neighbor or near friend, and one who has, in the highest degree, merited of me, in extreme distress and ready to perish, I find an indifference in my heart with respect to anything proposed to be done, which I can easily do for his relief. So if it should be proposed to me to blaspheme God, or kill my father, or do numberless other things, which might be mentioned, the being indifferent for a moment would be highly vicious and vile. And it may be further observed that to suppose this liberty of indifference is essential to virtue and vice destroys the great difference of degrees of the guilt of different crimes, and takes away the heinousness of the most flagitious, horrid iniquities, such as adultery, bestiality, murder, perjury, blasphemy, etc. For, according to these principles, there's no harm at all in having the mind in a state of perfect indifference with respect to these crimes. Nay, it is absolutely necessary in order to any virtue in avoiding them, or vice in doing them. But for the mind to be in a state of indifference with respect to them is to be next door to doing them. It is then infinitely near to choosing, and so committing the fact. For equilibrium is the next step to a degree of preponderation. And one, even the least degree of preponderation, all things considered, is choice. And not only so, but for the will to be in a state of perfect equilibrium with respect to such crimes is for the mind to be in such a state as to be full as likely to choose them as to refuse them, to do them as to omit them. And if our minds be in such a state wherein it is as near to choosing as refusing, and wherein it must be of necessity according to the nature of things, be as likely to commit them as to refrain from them. Where is the exceeding heinousness of choosing and committing them? If there be no harm in often being in such a state, wherein the probability of doing and forbearing are exactly equal, there being an equilibrium, and no more tendency to one than the other, then, according to the nature and laws of such a contingence, it may be expected as an inevitable consequence of such a disposition of things, that we should choose them as often as reject them. That it should generally so fall out is necessary, as equality in the effect is the natural consequence of the equal tendency of the cause, or of the antecedent state of things from which the effect arises. Why then should we be so exceedingly to blame if it does so fall out? It is many ways apparent that the Arminian scheme of liberty is utterly inconsistent with the being of any such things as either virtuous or vicious habits or dispositions. If liberty of indifference be essential to moral agency, then there can be no virtue in any habitual inclinations of the heart, which are contrary to indifference, and imply in their nature the very destruction and exclusion of it. They suppose nothing can be virtuous in which no liberty is exercised. But how absurd is it to talk of exercising indifference under bias and preponderation? And if self-determining power in the will be necessary to moral agency, praise, blame, etc., then nothing done by the will can be any further praiseworthy or blameworthy than so far as the will is moved, swayed, and determined by itself, and the scales turned by the sovereign power the will has over itself. And therefore, the will must not be out of its balance. Preponderation must not be determined and effected beforehand. And so, the self-determining act anticipated. Thus, it appears another way, that habitual bias is inconsistent with that liberty, which Arminians suppose to be necessary to virtue or vice. And so it follows, that habitual bias itself cannot be either virtuous or vicious. The same thing follows from their doctrine concerning the inconsistence of necessity with liberty, praise, dispraise, etc. None will deny that bias and inclination may be so strong as to be invincible and leave no possibility of the will determining contrary to it, and so be attended with necessity. This, Dr. Whitby allows concerning the will of God, angels, and glorified saints with respect to good, and the will of devils with respect to evil. Therefore, if necessity be inconsistent with liberty, then, when fixed inclination is to such a degree of strength, it utterly excludes all virtue, vice, praise, or blame. And, if so, then the nearer habits are to this strength, the more do they impede liberty, and so diminish praise and blame. If very strong habits destroy liberty, the lesser ones proportionably hinder it, according to their degree of strength. And therefore, it will follow that then is the act most virtuous or vicious, when performed without any inclination or habitual bias at all, because it is then performed with most liberty. Every prepossessing fixed bias on the mind brings a degree of moral inability for the contrary, because, so far as the mind is biased and prepossessed, so much hindrance is there of the contrary. And therefore, if moral inability be inconsistent with moral agency, or the nature of virtue and vice, then, so far as there is any such thing as evil disposition of heart, or habitual depravity of inclination, whether covetousness, pride, malice, cruelty, or whatever else, well, so much the more excusable persons are, so much the less have their evil acts of this kind the nature of vice. And on the contrary, whatever excellent dispositions and inclinations they have so much, are they the less virtuous. Now it is evident that no habitual disposition of heart can be in any degree virtuous or vicious, or the actions which proceed from them at all praiseworthy or blameworthy. Because, though we should suppose the habit not to be of such strength as completely to take away all moral ability and self-determining power, or maybe partly from bias and in part from self-determination, yet in this case, all that is from antecedent bias must be set aside as of no consideration, and in estimating the degree of virtue or vice, no more must be considered than what arises from self-determining power, without any influence of that bias, because liberty is exercised in no more. So that all that is the exercise of habitual inclination is thrown away, as not belonging to the morality of the action, by which it appears that no exercise of these habits, let them be stronger or weaker, can ever have anything of the nature of either virtue or vice. And here, if anyone should say that notwithstanding all these things, there may be the nature of virtue in vice, or virtue and vice, in the habits of the mind, because these habits may be the effects of those acts wherein the mind exercised liberty, that however the forementioned reasons will prove that no habits which are natural, or that are born or created with us, can be either virtuous or vicious, yet they will not prove this of habits which have been acquired and established by repeated free acts. To such an objector, well, I would say that this evasion will not at all help the matter. For if freedom of will be essential to the very nature of virtue and vice, then there is no virtue or vice, but only in that very thing wherein this liberty is exercised. If a man in one or more things that he does exercises liberty, and then by those acts is brought into such circumstances that his liberty ceases, and there follows a long series of acts or events that come to pass necessarily, those consequent acts are not virtuous or vicious, rewardable or punishable, but only the free acts that establish this necessity, for in them alone was the man free. The following effects that are necessary have no more of the nature of virtue or vice than health or sickness of body have properly the nature of virtue or vice, being the effects of a course of free acts of temperance or intemperance. Or then the good qualities of a clock are of the nature of virtue, which are the effects of free acts of the artificer. Or the goodness and sweetness of the fruits of a garden are moral virtues, being the effects of the free and faithful acts of the gardener. If liberty be absolutely requisite to the morality of actions, and necessity completely inconsistent with it, as Arminians greatly insist, then no necessary effects whatsoever, let the cause be never so good or bad, can be virtuous or vicious. But the virtue or vice must be only in the free cause. Agreeably to this, Dr. Whitby supposes that the necessity that attends the good and evil habits of the saints in heaven and damned in hell, which are the consequence of their free acts in their state of probation, are not rewardable or punishable. On the whole, it appears that if the notions of Arminians concerning liberty and moral agency be true, well, it will follow that there is no virtue in any such habits or qualities as humility, meekness, patience, mercy, gratitude, generosity, heavenly mindedness, nothing at all praiseworthy in loving Christ above father and mother, wife and children, or even our own lives, or in delight in holiness, hungering and thirsting after righteousness, love to enemies, universal benevolence to mankind. And on the other hand, there is nothing at all vicious or worthy of dispraise in the most sordid, beastly, malignant, devilish dispositions, in being ungrateful, profane, habitually hating God and things sacred and holy, or in being most treacherous, envious, and cruel towards men. For all these things are dispositions and inclinations of the heart. And, in short, there is no such thing as any virtuous or vicious quality of mind, no such thing as inherent virtue and holiness, or vice and sin. And the stronger those habits or dispositions are, which used to be called virtuous and vicious, the further they are from being so indeed. The more violent men's lusts are, the more fixed their pride, envy, ingratitude, and maliciousness. Still, the further are they from being blameworthy. If there be a man that by his own repeated acts, or by any other means, is come to be of the most hellish disposition, desperately inclined to treat his neighbors with injuriousness, or contempt, and malignity, the further they should be from any disposition to be angry with him, or in the least to blame him. So, on the other hand, if there be a person who is of a most excellent spirit, strongly inclining him to the most amiable actions, admirably meek, benevolent, etc., so much is he further from anything rewardable or commendable. On which principles, the man Jesus Christ was very far from being praiseworthy for those acts of holiness and kindness which he performed, these propensities being strong in his heart. This is according to the view of the Arminian. And above all, the infinitely holy and gracious God is infinitely remote from anything commendable, his good inclinations being infinitely strong, and he, therefore, at the utmost possible distance from being at liberty. And in all cases, the stronger the inclinations of any are to virtue, the more they love it, the less virtuous, and the more they love wickedness, the less vicious they are. Whether these things are agreeable to Scripture, well, let every Christian and every man who has read the Bible judge. And whether they are agreeable to common sense, let everyone judge that has human understanding in exercise. And if we pursue these principles, we shall find that virtue and vice are completely excluded out of the world, that is the principles of the Arminian notion of liberty, and that there never was, nor ever can be, any such thing as one or the other, either in God, angels, or men. No propensity, disposition, or habit can be virtuous or vicious, as has been shown, because they, so far as they take place, destroy the freedom of the will, the foundation of all moral agency, and exclude all capacity of either virtue or vice. And if habits and dispositions themselves be not virtuous nor vicious, well, neither can the exercise of these dispositions be so. For the exercise of bias is not the exercise of free, self-determining will, and so there is no exercise of liberty in it. Consequently, no man is virtuous or vicious, either in being well or ill-disposed, nor in acting from a good or bad disposition. And whether this bias or disposition be habitual or not, if it exists but a moment before the act of will, which is the effect of it, well, it alters not the case as to the necessity of the effect. Or, if there be no previous disposition at all, either habitual or occasional, that determines the act, then it is not choice that determines it. It is therefore a contingence that happens to the man, arising from nothing in him, and is necessary as to any inclination or choice of his, and, therefore, cannot make him either the better or worse, any more than a tree is better than other trees, because it oftener happens to be lighted upon by a nightingale, or a rock more vicious than the other rocks, because rattlesnakes have happened oftener to crawl over it. So, that there is no virtue nor vice in good or bad dispositions, either fixed or transient, nor any virtue or vice in acting from any good or bad previous inclination, nor yet any virtue or vice in acting completely without any previous inclination. Where then shall we find room for virtue or vice? I'm going to go ahead and stop it there.